I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.
Because there's no agreement on government funding, the American government has shut down. How will this affect our healthcare? What happens next? Our guest, Laura Rodriguez from Center for American Progress, is here to talk about it. Welcome to Care Talk Live, where we talk about how healthcare works or doesn't work in America and get you answers. I'm Laura Packard, cancer survivor and healthcare advocate, here to help you. Please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-6837, and our experts will answer them in future episodes. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts to get next week's Care Talk show. In today's episode, Laura Rodriguez talks about the government shutdown and what that means for you. So welcome, Laura Rodriguez, the Senior Vice President for Government Affairs at American Progress.
Hey, Laura. So nice to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So let's start with the government shutdown. What does that mean?
Well, this is what they call a full government shutdown. Both sides were not able to agree, as you mentioned right at the top, on a funding bill for the government. So every year, just going to go really, really quick summary. Every year, there are what they call appropriations bills. There are 12 of them. Each bill addresses a different part of the government. So they'll have a bill that funds the actual government, legislative areas. They have a bill that funds the military. Every single one is, you know, there's packages of them, and there's 12 of them. So every year, Democrats and Republicans come together with the Appropriations Committee, and they get together and they write these bills in a bipartisan way, then they vote them out of the committee, and then those get voted on the floor, and then the government is funded. It has to be done by September 30th every year. Your audience has probably seen that in the last few years, there's been a lot of either shutdown scares or actual shutdowns in the last 8 years. We've had a couple. And that is because they just couldn't come up with an agreement. And in this case, we have a really special kind of shutdown, and special not in a good way. It's really different. Why? Because aside from the fact that they just couldn't agree on how to fund the government, there's an underlying issue that is very unique to this current situation. Your watchers, your viewers may have heard about something called a rescissions package. A rescissions package means that the administration says, hey, Congress, you all passed $5 to spend on pens for, you know, the State Department. We don't really want to do that. We don't think it's necessary. We want to take that back. So they propose a rescissions package, including that and whatever else they want to fix, basically, in the appropriations from the year before. And then both parties usually come and they vote on it together, and it usually passes in a bipartisan way because it's usually a fix that both parties think is necessary. In this case, it was passed in a partisan way. The Democrats did not agree at all with any of the cutbacks that the administration wanted to make, and these were things that were put into law. And because they did that in a partisan way, and because the president and his administration have continued to say that they want to cut more and more from appropriations, there's no deal to be made until there's something that says that when they do make a deal, when they do come up with an agreement, that it's going to actually happen.
Okay, that makes sense. Given that the two sides are not really negotiating because they don't or can't trust each other, what's going to happen? How long is the government going to be shut down?
Well, it's like I said, it's a really unique situation. And actually, maybe minutes before I came on here, apparently President Trump is saying that he is talking to Democrats and that they are starting to think about a way out. I think the real thing that's happening right now is that we do need President Trump to get into this conversation because of exactly what I said before, right? If he's behind it, then they're not going to be as concerned that it's going to be clawed back later on. So we'll see what comes out of it. We don't know how serious the talks are. We're always kind of watching for whether it's, you know, it's real or not. But right now, I do think that Republicans and the administration are seeing very clearly that Americans care about health insurance, about their health, more than anything. I mean, everyone's like trying to make ends meet on a lot of things, but healthcare is very much up there with the highest costs and a lot of folks' family budgets. So combine that with the fact that they have both the House and the Senate and the administration. A lot of Americans are saying, Republicans, this is on you all. You guys need to help, you know, you guys need to get to a deal in order to open the government. This is on you. So this is maybe what we're seeing with these new negotiations. Maybe it's a little bit of a turn in that direction.
So the last time the government shut down was in December several years ago, also under President Trump. What ended that shutdown?
He gave in. Historically, and this is, again, another unique situation. Historically, the party that asks for something in order to bring the government back into functioning doesn't get it. And that's happened both with Democratic and Republican fights on this. So basically, they just kind of gave up. It had gone on, I believe, for 35 days. I actually happened to be a chief of staff in the House side at that time, and it was pretty chaotic and nobody could vote on anything. You couldn't vote on bills or pass anything because the government was shut down. And they had to actually swear people in on a special special session because it was a year where it was an election year. Right. So there's a bunch of people who had just been elected into Congress. And so they had to be sworn in under a special session. It was all very chaotic. But at the end of the day, there was no movement. And the administration had to kind of give in and say, like, let's just give them what they want or not get what we want, which was to do away with Obamacare and open up the government. They kind of gave up.
Okay, so we'll see if the same thing happens this time around. Let's talk about what the current threats to the Affordable Care Act are right now. Can you talk about the formerly called Big Beautiful Bill and what that does not do for the Affordable Care Act?
Oh, absolutely. In the One Big Beautiful Bill negotiations, this is another time when Democrats came to Republicans and said, you all are doing this reconciliation bill. It is, and it's in and of itself a budget bill. Put in the fix for these premium tax credits that need to be extended. Put it all in the one package, and we can be done with this. It doesn't have to be dramatic. It doesn't have to, you know, affect and become a fight. They didn't want to do it. They said it was too expensive. I don't know what changes between then and now, because now they're saying they do want to fix it, but just not right now, this moment. So let's talk about why right now it's important. So these premium tax credits were a product of COVID era policy where, you know, folks were struggling. And so more tax credits were given to more middle income Americans. They were set to expire at the end of this year. So December 30th or 31st, I guess. So a lot of Republicans will say, well, that's an end of year problem. But why is it a problem now? It's a problem now because, as many of, again, your viewers might know, shopping season is about to start for health insurance. The ACA marketplace will open up for registration on November 1st. And so when you're shopping around for whatever you're shopping around for, but especially in this case, for your healthcare policy, if you see that something's going up by at least 75% next year, you might decide you can't afford it. And the folks who decide that they can't afford it, that it's too much, are usually going to be younger, healthier people who are going to take the chance of just kind of winging it for now and trying to, you know, go down the road and get it later. And then that instead goes and raises everybody else's rates as well, because they're the folks who kind of even out the pricing for insurance companies, and they don't have to charge as much because the pool is much more even. So this is what we're talking about. It's happening now, right? November 1st, it opens up. People are shopping in about a week. They're going to get letters in the mail real soon saying this is how much your insurance, your same plan is going to cost next year. And on average, it's going to be about 75% higher. It's pretty dangerous. And a lot of people are just not going to do it.
I'm one of those people. I'm waiting for my letter in the mail any day now to find out how much my insurance premiums are going to go up for next year. So this is critical to solve this right now. So what can or should Congress do besides open up the government in that budget? What should they be doing?
I think there needs to be a real conversation about these specific things. We saw in the One Big Beautiful Bill, not only did they not fix this, but they cut funding for Medicaid, which is going to affect Medicare. And that's a more complicated story. But they seem to continue to cut more and more healthcare for Americans. But they keep saying that they care about healthcare for Americans, that they want Americans to have healthcare. But all of their actions are showing something different. So they need to come to the table. They need to really see what is happening, why it's needed to do now. It needs to be done now, excuse me. And the reality is, right now, Democrats are saying they would like an extension of the tax credits, a permanent extension. It's an expensive thing. They're also saying they want to claw back some of those Medicaid cuts in the One Big Beautiful Bill. And the third thing is what I mentioned earlier, they want to make sure a deal's a deal. If they're going to get into a deal with them, those dollars need to actually go out the door to help people, to help Americans. So they need to come to the table. That is a negotiating position. Everyone knows that's how you negotiate, right? You come to the table with an offer. The other side's going to come with another offer. Bring an offer. They say they want to fix it. Then sit down and bring Democrats an offer that addresses some of the issues that Americans care about the most, which is their healthcare.
And finally, how can we stop having all these government shutdowns? You know, what is the fix that would make this stop happening?
Well, going through the actual appropriations process and having it work and function the way it's meant to, which is what I explained a little bit earlier, right? Having the committees and the appropriations do each bill, pass each bill, and then take it to the floor and it passes on the floor. This is regular order. That's how we fix government shutdowns, is regular order. But that means bipartisanship, especially in the Senate, but sometimes also in the House. No matter what, there's always going to be folks that they're going to need. They're going to need folks on the other side. So it necessarily is going to need bipartisanship. It's going to need negotiation. But they should just be doing regular order bills as the law intended, pass it, and then have the administration, whichever administration, dole out the dollars the way that Congress passed it, and make sure that they are helping Americans as it was intended by Congress.
Thank you so much for joining us today, for explaining the shutdown and what happens next. And like you said, we need a government that works better so that when Congress allocates money, it is then spent the way that it's meant to be. So thanks again for joining us. And now our experts will answer your health insurance questions. So welcome, Diane Archer, founder and president of Just Care USA and senior advisor on Medicare at Social Security Works, and Louise Norris, health insurance and healthcare reform analyst at healthinsurance.org. So let's start with the first piece of news, which is the latest deal announced by President Trump in the White House on drug pricing with Pfizer. So what is this deal? What does it mean, Diane?
Okay, really good question. The devil is always in the details. So here's what we know. We know that the Trump administration made this deal with Pfizer that is, at least at this point, only benefiting Pfizer. Pfizer, as a result of the deal, will not face tariffs on its drugs manufactured abroad for the next 3 years. As a result, Pfizer's stock shot up after the deal. And what we then know is that experts are skeptical as to whether the deal will bring down drug costs for Americans because its stock price shot up. So that would indicate that its profits are not suffering as a result of this deal. So the details, as I said, are fuzzy, but here are three things Pfizer agreed to do. The first was to ensure that Medicaid pays the same low prices for drugs as other wealthy countries. The second, that Pfizer would sell a group of brand name drugs at direct to consumer at a discount. And the third, that when Pfizer brought new drugs to market, it would be at the same price other countries pay. So while all these sound good, remember, Pfizer is not losing money. After the deal, its stock price shot up. So here are some more of the details which begin to shed light on why Americans may not benefit from this deal, and people are skeptical. Number one, Medicaid already pays low drug prices, and people with Medicaid already pay little or nothing for their drugs. So it's unclear if the deal will help reduce Medicaid spending for the states or the federal government, or reduce out-of-pocket costs for people with Medicaid. It's not so likely. As for brand-name drugs, the concern is that Pfizer will discount the price of drugs that have already lost their patents, or drugs that are about to lose their patents, and that drugs that are not the blockbuster drugs, but the drugs that help only a small group of people. Because as I said, we still don't know which drugs will be discounted or to what extent. So if that's the case, and it's only drugs that have generic substitutes or that are going off patent, this deal will offer almost no benefit to Americans. And insured Americans who could get their drugs potentially at a discount here will likely be better off paying copays for their drugs than the full cost at a discounted price. And then finally, as for the price of new drugs, pharmaceutical companies tend to launch these drugs in the United States. So Pfizer can continue to say whatever it wants and charge whatever it wants for these new drugs, since there won't be a benchmark of the cost of these same drugs in other countries. They'll only be available in the US. So more to learn, and maybe something good will come out of this, but as of now, as you've heard, there's just a lot of reason for skepticism.
Thanks, Diane. So right now it sounds more like hype than actual lower drug prices. In a future episode, I think we'll get into the fact that Colorado is the first in the nation. Their prescription drug affordability board passed upper payment limits on a drug, Enbrel. So first state in the country to actually limit the price of a drug. So we'll see what happens in Colorado and in other states, but that's something that is not going to be just hype. So more to come on that. We've talked before, or we've heard guests talk about the subsidy cliff for marketplace coverage. Louise, can you explain what is the subsidy cliff? And if people are on the cliff, what can they do about it?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So the subsidy cliff refers to the fact that when the ACA was first passed and enacted, it provided subsidies, premium tax credits, but only if you didn't earn more than 400% of the federal poverty level. If you were above 400% of the federal poverty level, the thinking back when they were enacting the ACA was that you earned enough to be able to afford health insurance without help. What we then found over the years as the ACA was implemented and premiums got solidified and people were buying their coverage was that, yes, if you earn maybe 1,000% of the federal poverty level, health insurance is still affordable for you even without help. But if you were just a little bit above 400% of the federal poverty level, health insurance could be really, really expensive, like a completely unaffordable percentage of your household income. And so this was referred to as the subsidy cliff because basically if you were earning, you know, say you were earning 395% of the federal poverty level, you might be getting a significant subsidy. And then you went to 401% of the federal poverty level, you got zero subsidy. So you sort of fell off of a cliff subsidy wise. If we look at the subsidy enhancements that Laura was talking about earlier in the show that were part of a COVID package back in 2021, what Congress did is they said, okay, we will remove temporarily this 400% of the poverty level cap on subsidy eligibility. And instead we'll say, if you're at that income or higher, you get a subsidy if the cost of health insurance would otherwise be more than 8.5% of your income. So, you know, if you're making $1 million a year, you're not getting a subsidy because health insurance isn't more than 8.5% of your income. But if you're making 450% of the poverty level, you may very well be getting a subsidy because otherwise health insurance would cost a lot more than 8.5% of your income. And this really varies depending on where you live. So if you are in a state where health insurance is more expensive than average, it makes a big deal. It's a big difference. And also if you are older, like older people, if you're, you know, 63, your premiums cost three times as much as a person who's 21. So that subsidy cliff becomes a much more significant problem if all of a sudden you have no subsidy and you're having to pay premiums that are the highest that anybody would pay. So these subsidy enhancements are scheduled to end at the end of 2025. If that happens, if Congress does not extend the subsidy enhancements, then suddenly people who earn more than 400% of the poverty level will once again qualify for no subsidies. And this could come as a real shock for people who have only joined the marketplace since 2021, and they don't realize that back before 2021, there were no subsidies available at that income level. So just to give people an idea of the sort of income we're talking about, in the continental United States, this is for one person, it's an income a little below $63,000 a year. For two people, it's a little below $85,000. And for a family of four, it's a little below $129,000. That's where the cutoffs are for next year's coverage. So if your income is going to go over those amounts, if Congress doesn't extend these subsidy enhancements, you are on the hook for paying the entire premium. And this is where we're looking at folks who are looking at their premium maybe going from a few hundred dollars a month this year to literally thousands of dollars a month next year. These would be the people who are hardest hit by the expiration of these subsidy enhancements. So one thing to keep in mind is the way income is calculated under the Affordable Care Act. If you are able to make contributions to a pre-tax retirement account, that will reduce your income. Also, if you're able to make contributions to a health savings account, that also will just be subtracted from your income when they're calculating what your income is. And all marketplace, bronze, and catastrophic plans will make you eligible for health savings account contributions next year. So that's a potential strategy folks can look at. If you enroll in a bronze plan, contribute to an HSA, that might be the thing that bumps your income from slightly too high to low enough to qualify for a subsidy, and not push you over into that subsidy cliff territory, but also contact your elected officials and let them know how much this is going to affect you in terms of asking them to extend these subsidy enhancements so that coverage can continue to be affordable for people who are, you know, middle-class Americans.
Thanks, Louise. And this kind of reminds me of the long discussion on Medicaid cuts. And just like it's important to understand with the Medicaid cuts, Medicaid is a very efficient program, and all the dollars, most of the dollars being spent are on care, sick and injured people getting the care they need. It's also important to understand for the Affordable Care Act subsidies that some elected officials may say, oh, well, these people don't need it, don't deserve it because they make too much money. But the thing is, with the caps at 8.5% of your income, if somebody is getting help, even if they make more than 400% of the federal poverty line, they're getting help because their health insurance is unaffordable. Even if they make more than $63,000, maybe they make $65,000, their health insurance costs are too high, and that's why they're getting the help. People who don't need help paying for their health insurance, like you said, if somebody's a millionaire, their health insurance premium is going to be under 8.5% of their income. They will not get the help. It's only the people that need help paying for it that receive it. So as you hear more about the subsidies and should people have subsidies, just keep in mind that the people who get the subsidies are people who whose health insurance costs more than that limit, so they need the help. Our next question is from Kimberly, and it's quite a long, involved, complicated question about COLA increases. And the gist of the question is that their Medicare Part B premium is very high, and can they get help paying for it because their income is low? So, Diane, what would you say to Kimberly and to other people in this situation?
I want to start by saying that other countries deal with the fact that different people have different incomes by having a more graduated tax system where wealthier people pay a lot more and get their free health care, and less wealthy people pay less and get their health care. And our system is designed to make it even challenging to get the benefits when you are entitled to them. And so it's the same with Medicare as it is with the ACA, in the sense that you are entitled to help paying your Medicare premiums and sometimes other costs, depending on your income. But wouldn't it be so much better if it was an automatic entitlement and not one where people had to apply? In the case of Medicare, you need to actually go through the Medicaid offices in your state to get help, and only if you have an income up to 138% of the federal poverty, and sometimes less than that, can you qualify for help. So we're not talking about anything expansive here at all. And because you have to go through a Medicaid office to get these benefits, and because that can be quite challenging, even reaching Medicaid offices on the phone or getting to them in person, only about half of people who are eligible for help paying their Medicare Part B premium and other benefits are currently enrolled. There are about 10 million of the 66 or so million people with Medicare who currently have the benefit, and then maybe as many as 10 million more who could qualify. So this is all a long way of saying, if your income is low, you should look into seeing if your Medicare premiums can be paid for through Medicaid. There's some of your income and assets that aren't counted for purposes of qualifying, and it's best not to assume that you don't qualify, and to actually reach out to Medicaid or to a state health insurance assistance program for free help and apply for the program, because best case scenario, you won't have the burden of paying a Medicare Part B premium and sometimes even the coinsurance and deductibles if you qualify.
Thanks, Diane. And I think you're exactly right in that too many programs are too difficult to access or sign up. And we would live in a better world, in a better country, if these things were automatic. If you qualify for a $0 Affordable Care Act health insurance plan, you should be automatically enrolled. If you qualify for Medicaid to help pay for your Medicare premiums, that should already be done for you. And this is, again, something that you can talk to your elected officials about, because there have been advances in making government work better and easier for people. Like IRS put together a tool to make it easier for you to file your taxes rather than having to pay a third-party company for their tax software. This was free and available to Americans, you know, for free to be able to do your taxes if your taxes were simple. And that's one of the things that got cut this year. So if you believe that government can and should work better for you, this is something you should talk to your senators and representative about, because they can do something about it.
I couldn't agree with you more.
And thank you, everyone, for joining us today to learn more about the government shutdown and how our healthcare system works or doesn't work in general. Please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll answer them in future episodes. Join us next week for more on healthcare in America. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Laura Packard, and this is Care Talk. Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.